Welcome to Parshas Tetzave / Parshas Zachor. Why are they two different Parshas? Well, the weekly Parshas Tetzave. And there's 4 weeks, starting right before the beginning of the month of Adar, where we add an additional reading from another section at the very end, following the regular weekly Parsha. This is the second of four. The first one was the Shabbos before the beginning of Adar, Rosh Chodesh, and that was the section dealing with the Shekalim, which is the donation of a half silver coin every year that the Jews made to furnish the temple with the sacrifices. And the second of the four special additional readings is this week, Zachor. It's where we add on the section from Kiseitse, that's at the end of Devarim, and we are called upon to remember what the nation of Amalek did to our people when we left Egypt. And they were the first nation to pick a fight with us after the miracles of Egypt, when all the other nations were terrified. And had they not done it, maybe we would never have an enemy. But because they did it, I guess they were the first suicide bombers, because the terrorists, because they did it, then everybody saw that it's okay to attack the Jews. And so we remember what they did. We always remember that. And we were also told to destroy, whenever we find an Amalekite, destroy him, destroy their property, animals, men, women, and children, that the nation of Amalek must be eradicated totally from the face of the earth. And this is a commandment from God, and God says, I will personally wage war with Amalek in every generation. And through our tradition, we understand that Amalek is really our worst enemy. And not just because they destroy us with military might, but because they represent no God, no spiritual reality whatsoever. They are the antithesis of the Jewish people. I would like to focus my remarks on the weekly Parsha. And if we have time at the end, maybe we'll talk about Purim. Purim and Amalek are closely related. According to the tradition, Haman was a descendant of Amalek. And therefore, the victory over Haman is really like a major victory over Amalek. So maybe we'll talk about that later on. But the Parsha itself is the story, not really a story, but a description of commandments revolving around the appointment of the high priest and his children who would minister in the Mishkan, the tabernacle, which we learned about last week. And there is an incredibly complex system of vestments, garments, clothing, that the Kohen Gadol was to wear. About half of the Parsha is devoted to what these clothing are and how they're made. So just like last week, we have an intricate design of the Mishkan, the building itself and the furnishings. This week we have an equally intricate design of clothing. And there were 8 garments in all. And you can read the list of clothing with the beginning on page 465. The bottom line is verse 4. These are the vestments that they shall make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a tunic of a box-like knit, a turban, and a sash. Right? That adds up to 8, right? Breastplate, ephod, robe, a tunic, a turban, and a sash. Right, 8. Oh, I think some are missing. Oh, so what's missing is the head plate, which is called the tzitz, and then there's also the trousers. Those are mentioned elsewhere. But there were eight garments that the Kohen Gadol had to wear. If he was missing one of those garments, he was in violation of these laws. And the other half of the parsha discusses the inauguration of the Kohen Gadol into service. So really the preoccupation of this parsha is the Kohen Gadol and all of his glory. Because these clothing, the Torah says, right, the verse before, and you shall speak, well, verse 2, you shall make vestments of sanctity for Aaron your brother, for glory and splendor. L'chavod u'l'sifares. For glory and splendor. So the whole parsha is about giving glory and honor to this man, Aaron. In this generation it would be Aaron, but this would be an office that would be perpetuated from generation to generation. There would always be a Kohen Gadol, and he would dress differently than anybody else in the nation, for glory and for splendor. What I'd like to discuss with you is, what exactly is the meaning of these glorious and splendorous clothing? Why is it so important? You know, we're not big on clothes and fancy designs. We're not into that. Why does the Torah emphasize the need of the Kohen Gadol to dress in such splendor? Well, I'm gonna just open this up briefly for a few moments to see if anybody has any comments on that.
Elevate the Kohen.
So that, why is it important that he be elevated?
He's a servant of God, and his servant isn't to portray an image that would show that he's not working just for any show of glow. He's working for the King of Kings.
Okay. So he's working for God. He's a servant in God's tabernacle. And we discussed last week about how to build a tabernacle and what it means for people to give and to give things that they're not totally ready to give, but they do it anyways because it's something that God asked us. And that's how we build a sanctuary, because we show that God is at the center. And this is now a man who works for God in the center arena, and therefore he needs to dress the part because of who he works for.
There's also an idea that clothes make the man, so to speak. And I remember hearing a teacher in my son's school saying that, you know, they didn't really have a dress code. The teachers could dress down, but she said she found herself more professional when she dressed higher up than when she wore the pants and all this kind of stuff. And maybe, I mean, since everything's leading up to an ideal that we should strive for, this amazing regal outfit is what we all should be focused on growing into being able to wear, so to speak. And him being the embodiment of our ideals, maybe that's what that's about.
I felt that the reason he was dressed the way he was to remind people that the Shekinah was supposed to be there. And you can't have a picture, or Shekinah isn't material, but this would be almost like a representation of it.
All right, so he represents the Shekhinah, the presence of the Shekhinah. The glory and splendor is really the glory and the splendor of the Shekhinah. Yeah, there. Thank you.
Also, he's going before him, so he certainly doesn't want to go before him dressed in Levi's.
Right. You know, actually, when he went into the Holy of Holies, he did dress down. He took off the colorful gold and, you know, crimson colored garments, and he put on plain white.
Yeah.
And he wore the simple clothing. Only four of them. That's interesting. The other was his normal garb, but when he went into the Holy of Holies, he put on the white. Now, yeah, there's a lot of commentaries. I encourage you to read the footnotes here, just for a couple. According to some, the Ramban, the garments represent the garb of royalty. According to the Sefarno, the vestments were for the glory of God and to lend splendor to the Kohen Gadol as the teacher of the nation, so that he would be revered by the tribes whose names he bore on his breast and shoulders. And I wanted to mention that as well. The two of the garments, the ephod, which was like an apron, you can see a picture of it on page 467 if you have a chumash. The ephod had shoulder straps which came up from behind and hung over the tops of the shoulders, and then connected by a chain, it held up the breastplate, which was right on his chest. Now, the shoulder straps had two stones on them, these black stones, and engraved on these stones were the names of the sons of Israel. Okay, this is in verse 9. You shall take the two Shoham stones and engrave upon them the names of the sons of Israel. Six of their names on one stone, and the names of the six remaining ones on the second stone, according to the order of their birth. So he's got the names of the tribes up here on his shoulders. And then, when the Torah describes the breastplate itself, it has 12 different gemstones on it. And the stones shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel. Again, he wore the names of the tribes on his chest. So he has them on his shoulders, and he has them on his chest, right over his heart. And one would really say that the Kohen Gadol had the weight of the Jewish people on his shoulders and in his heart. Okay.
Aaron was a Levite, right?
Aaron was a Levite, yes.
All right, and this is where he is made a Kohen.
That's right. The second half of the Parsha is the inaugural service that would be to make Aaron into a Kohen. That's right. The truth is that I really wanted to utilize this opportunity to discuss more about the Kohen Gadol and his function and his greatness. You know, one thing is for sure, that if this is the only man in all of Israel that wears such fancy clothing, then there must be something special about him. And I don't think he's special because he wears the clothing. I think he wears the clothing because he's special. And Rav Dessler gives us some very, very keen insights into the nature of this great man. And not just the first one, Aaron, but really this position carries with it. And what I'd like to do is share some insights from Rav Dessler on the nature of the Kohen Gadol, and hopefully from this to derive some insight into our own roles as individual Jews. A couple of things we know about the Kohen Gadol, besides what clothing he wore, is that he had a tremendous amount of power. I don't mean power of rulership. He wasn't the king. But spiritually, he had a tremendous amount of power. All right, an example of this is in the book of Vayikra, Leviticus, in the Parsha of Acharei Mos, where the Torah prescribes the special service conducted in the tabernacle on Yom Kippur. This is actually the Torah reading that we read every Yom Kippur. And this was one day a year when the Kohen Gadol did all of the service himself. The other days, it was mostly delegated to the Kohanim. But on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol had to do everything himself. And what the effects of all of these sacrifices, which he was busy from early morning, way before dawn, until late in the day. One of the effects of all of this is that it was Yom HaKippurim, it was the Day of Atonement. And this was very much affected by the service of the Kohen Gadol. The Torah describes how the Kohen Gadol would have to approach the animal and do what's called Semicha, leaning his full weight on the animal and uttering the words of confession. I'll just read a couple of words here. He shall slaughter the sin offering he-goat of the people and wring its blood within the curtain. He shall do with its blood as he had done with the blood of the bull, etc. Verse 16, chapter 16, verse 16 in Leviticus. Thus he shall provide atonement upon the sanctuary for the contaminations of the children of Israel, even for their rebellious sins among all their sins. Any person shall not be in the tent of meeting when he comes to provide atonement in the sanctuary until his departure. He shall provide atonement for himself, for his household, and for the entire congregation of Israel. One man on Yom Kippur Day is able to provide atonement for the entire nation, for all of their sins, rebellious and all kinds of sins, inadvertent, intentional. One man provides atonement for the entire nation. That's pretty powerful. You know, I mean, atonement means that everything is erased, that the sins are erased. One would not need to undergo the punishments or the suffering brought about by sins because this one man did some service. It sounds like hocus pocus. What's the magic trick?
Goes in with the when the air is with the divine presence is.
Yeah.
And then again, I don't know whether it worked always or not, because it was the time during when the Romans were in charge and sort of went to die as bitter.
Right.
It was an annual position because every time they went in, they would die.
Right. The Kohen Gadol position became, later years, became occupied by less than sincere candidates. That's true. You know, people saw the clothing and the honor and the glory as the focus and not really what the Kohen was all about. That's what we're really here to discover. What was really the Kohen all about? It wasn't just about clothing.
In the Yom Kippur reading, they also talked about how if one of the people serving as Kohen Gadol couldn't read the service or there would be people to help him out.
Right. Could you imagine that the Kohen Gadol can't read Hebrew?
Yeah.
It was a sad commentary on the times that the even ignorant cult people were standing in that position, but okay, let's continue on. So one idea is that the Kohen Gadol has power in that he can effect atonement for the entire nation on Yom Kippur. It needs explanation how one person can expiate the sins of others. Sounds a little. this sounds like something else. But it says it right here in the Torah.
Except that he was asking for atonement for things they had done. At least he wasn't asking for atonement for things they hadn't even done yet.
Right.
That's the other
okay.
thing you were talking about.
Okay. Now, another thing, which is just as surprising and shocking, is what we find in the book of Bamidbar, Lamed Hey, chapter 35. How many people are familiar with the law of the cities of refuge? Okay, the Torah provides, the God in the Torah provides for cities of refuge throughout the land of Israel when the people will move there to provide a haven for someone who had basically committed manslaughter. Mm-hmm. Even though he was not careful and he caused the death of another Jew, but it was not premeditated, it was not intentional, and so as to atone, as to protect himself from the wrath of the relatives, the Torah calls them the avengers of the blood, the Torah provided a haven in the cities of refuge. But it wasn't merely just a haven, it was actually, you know, that was a side benefit, but he was actually sent there, and it was like a sentence. He was committed to those cities, that one of those cities of refuge, indefinitely, because he really, you know, was not completely blameless. He wasn't careful. He may have been negligent, causing the death of this other person. And so he was sent to the city of refuge. And the Torah says, how long is his sentence? So it says something which doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. The assembly shall rescue the killer from the hand of the avenger of the blood, and the assembly here refers to the court, shall return him to his city of refuge where he had fled. He shall dwell in it until the death of the Kohen Gadol, whom one had anointed with the sacred oil. There's no time limit on that. It's whenever the Kohen Gadol dies. It could be soon. It could be in 50 years. You know, depending how old he was. And what's the explanation of that? Why does the death of the Kohen Gadol have anything to do with an inadvertent killer leaving the city of refuge?
Because if he properly prayed, it wouldn't have happened.
You know too much. That's wonderful. So the Talmud says, let me just relate a little, kind of a funny side to this. Funny. It's true, but the Talmud relates that if the Kohen Gadol was a younger man and he still had his mother living, she would make her rounds to the different cities and bring care packages to the, we'll call them the inmates, so that they could, well, there's two versions, either that they, so that they won't pray that her son should die, or that they will pray that their son, that her son shouldn't die.
Should live.
Right. In other words, she's got to appeal to these people who killed so that for her son to live. Because they obviously want him to die so they can go free. So she's got to go and butter them up and make them feel that they're well cared for, that it's not so bad living here. And so that they will either won't die, that pray that he should die, or pray that he should live. And the Talmud says, "What? Why is it up to them? You mean if they don't pray, then God's going to cause the Kohen Gadol to die before his time? That's what it sounds like." And the Talmud says, yes, it's true. Because the Kohen Gadol is responsible for this tragedy. The Kohen Gadol is responsible for the tragedy of this death. And the Talmud cites an illustration of this. There was once a great rabbi, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, who used to be at such a high level that Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, used to visit him all the time. And one day he noticed Eliyahu hasn't come. And he said, well, maybe tomorrow. He didn't come the next day. And he didn't come the day after that. And he got nervous. He says, what have I done? Maybe I've lost my good favor in the eyes of Eliyahu. So he found out, Eliyahu said, the reason why I did not appear to you is because 10 miles away, a man was eaten by a lion. So that's why I didn't appear to you. What? 10 miles away from me, a man was eaten by a lion? Yeah, it's your fault. Now this is not the Kohen Gadol, but this is a great tzaddik. It's your fault. You should have prayed. The Talmud says that the Kohen Gadol and tzaddikim in general can pray that tragedies don't happen in the Jewish community. And if they don't pray and tragedies do happen, they're held responsible. Whoa. These garments, these glorified garments, come along with some pretty heavy strings. You mean because the Kohen Gadol is wearing these garments, he is expected to prevent tragedies from happening? What does it mean? It
seems like this is exactly parallel to what you said last week about the people. You know, when the Jewish people, when the inner the heart of the Jewish people is pure, then the tabernacle will flourish. And when it's not, will be in Golis.
Okay. Now, there's only very good, now I didn't think of that really what's going on in the inside of the Jewish people's hearts is what determines our physical well-being.
Exactly. And so
but,
the same thing.
But this is going a much bigger jump, because what we're saying over here is that one man,
right,
can change the physical well-being of the nation.
And he represents.
And how could that be? And Rav Dessler asks a further question. He says, you know, the Talmud also explains that when these kind of tragedies happen, it's not just random. When an accident happens and somebody gets killed, even though it was not intentional, this is a judgment from heaven. It means the Talmud has a very convoluted case, but let's say that what happened was somebody was going up a ladder, actually going down a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's exempt if he goes up the ladder. Mm-hmm. He's going down the ladder, and the ladder the rung breaks, and he slips, and he falls down on top of another guy who was walking under the ladder, and he kills him. So the guy under the ladder dies. The guy that was coming down the ladder has to go to the city of refuge because he killed somebody, you know, inadvertently, but he should have been more careful. So the Talmud says, you know, why did this occur? The Talmud says it must be that the person who had fallen had once another time committed a crime, and there was no witnesses, so they couldn't send him to the city. So he was caused to do it again. This time there were witnesses, and he would go to the city. And the guy who died must be that he once committed a crime which made him guilty of the death penalty, but there were no witnesses, so God made him die in another way. In other words, tragedies don't just happen without reason. There must be a reason. It's a judgment. Everything that happens in the world is just. You know, God is in control, and he can prevent tragedies if they aren't supposed to happen, and he can make them happen if they are supposed to happen. So Rav Dessler says, so I don't understand. If the person that died was supposed to die, why is the prayer of the Kohen Gadol going to change that? I mean, if it's justice, it's justice. And how is it fact that, besides the fact that, how does he have that power, but why is it even justified for him to pray and to exonerate the man from his death penalty?
So how is that explained?
So, this is what Rav Dessler says, and I'm just trying to understand it myself fully, but I'll try to tell you what I understand. What's it all about?
Alfie?
Yeah. What's the world all about? And I'm going to do, we've gone through this several times because, you know, in so much of Jewish thought, we have to really keep on going back to remind ourselves, what's it all about? We've studied the words of Rabbi Luzzatto many times. It's all about God creating a world so that we can connect with him by our choice, and thereby ultimately earn the ultimate goodness. Okay, you sound a little familiar, Rabbi Luzzatto? We have to earn it ourselves, so God doesn't make it too obvious, because if it would be too obvious, then we really wouldn't have earned it, and if we didn't earn it, we can't really enjoy it. It's not really ours. So he creates a world with all kinds of masks, and the good is out there if you find it, but it's surrounded by all kinds of other things, good and evil, all mixed together, and it's mixed together inside of us, and it's mixed together in the outside world. There's good people and bad people, there's good thoughts and bad thoughts, good intentions and bad intentions, and all this is mixed together, and we are supposed to make sense out of it and find the good. And the purpose of that is to, again, to reveal the good, and by revealing the good, to connect ourselves to God. So, any time a Jew makes a choice to do something for God, a mitzvah, or a good deed, study Torah, pray, he reveals the goodness a little more. And everybody has a part of, you know, the spark of the divine inside of him or her neshama. And therefore, every person has the opportunity to reveal a little bit more. And when one person, and the contrary, unfortunately, if we choose not to, then God becomes hidden. Because we're not choosing God, we're choosing something else. So the whole world is a constant balancing act between revealing God and hiding God. And each person has an important role, and each person is, so to speak, indispensable. But sometimes people don't do their part for whatever reason. So there's a lot of darkness in the world because of that. Now, a Kohen Gadol, we're going to go straight to the Kohen Gadol, he stands before God and he utters this prayer, and he does it on Yom Kippur. And this is the prayer that, according to the Talmud, he should be constantly saying. And the prayer, I'm just piecing together from Rav Dessa's words, the prayer should go something like this. Listen to the prayer of the Kohen Gadol. This is what he thinks about. God, I'm terribly distressed over the situation in the world here. And God says, what's wrong? He says, don't you have everything you need? You know, you're a very holy person. You're very close to me. I take care of you. You're my servant. He says, yes, but that's not so important because look at the whole world. Look at as a totality. You're very hidden in the world. And nothing is worth it for me. Just because I know all about you, it's not worth it for me if you're hidden to the world. Please, we need everybody to reveal their part. And if they can't reveal their part, then my life is not worth it. Because we're all in this for one reason, and we're all in it together to reveal God's presence in the world. And actually, this is reminiscent of the words of Moshe in the next parsha, when the Jews committed the sin of the golden calf. Hashem said, all right, forget them. I'll just destroy them all. Moshe, you stay with me. I'll make a new nation from you. What was Moshe's response? If you destroy the people, take me out of your book. Same thing. I'm not in this for myself. It's not me and you, God. It's the world and God, or the Jewish people who are given the ability, the knowledge, the insight to be able to reveal God through the commandments, through the Torah. That's what we're here for. And if it's not done, then my life has no meaning. So the Kohen Gadol, he says this all the time. That's his prayer. He prays for everybody. Just like he has the name. That's what it means. He's got the names on his heart and on his shoulders. He is not living for himself. He is totally consumed with what's happening with the entire community, with the entire world, and how God is being revealed or not being revealed. Now, when he does that, when he makes that prayer, when he comes to the conclusion that he's willing to give up his whole connection to God, his whole personal connection to God, for the sake of the collective connection to God, when he does that, he reveals a tremendous amount of light and sanctity and presence of God into the world. It's really that prayer itself, his own thoughts, that shows that what's important in the world is that God be revealed to all of mankind. It's his expression of prayer, it's his expression of concern and feeling of collective responsibility, is that's what makes God's presence a reality and a value. When he does that, he actually restores all of the missing light, the missing spiritual illumination that all the people didn't reveal. He actually restores it.
What is the thought behind why the Kohen was designated to be this emissary? Why the Kohen, not the Israelites?
Well, I'm going to get to that. It's really not, it's not exclusive to the Kohen. But the Kohen Gadol, that was his job, and he was selected because he had this value. He lived for the sake of seeing God's presence revealed into the world. And we're going to say that it's not exclusive to him either. So, if somebody committed a sin, and because of that he caused a great desecration of God's name and a lot of darkness to enter into the world, right? Ordinarily, this person, this transgressor, might have to experience some punishment, because that would, he says that punishment actually reveals God into the world too, unfortunately through the attribute of strict justice. But if the Kohen Gadol can reveal it in another way, then the person does not have to undergo the punishment. That's the power of the Kohen Gadol. By his recognizing the importance of everybody's spiritual contribution, he can avoid punishments to come to other people. It's an amazing thing. It's kind of hocus pocus, a little spooky here. But one man, by his collective feeling of responsibility to reveal the reality of God, can actually prevent tragedies from happening, which are decreed by the divine attribute of justice. And that's how his prayers could have avoided the tragedy, and that's why the people, by praying on behalf of the Kohen Gadol, what they're really doing is that they're now taking responsibility for that lost illumination, and thereby the Kohen Gadol doesn't have to suffer for his inability to do so. It's kind of complicated, but that the bottom line is that we are all interconnected, and that we are all here for one common goal, and that is to sanctify the name of God, Kiddush Hashem. And we can actually bring about Kiddush Hashem for one another. Okay, let's take a little question here, and then we'll wrap it up.
Were you saying that punishments come to reveal Hashem in one way?
Mm-hmm.
But the Kohen Gadol's prayer can alleviate this by davening that he can reveal through our good actions.
Correct.
I can ask a question. I think I'm fairly intelligent. I read through this last parsha.
You didn't see any of this.
That's right. And my question to you is, evidently, the fact that I didn't start when I was this high, that's the reason I'm having problem now.
Not really. This is not, Rabbi Dessler's writings are not exactly elementary school. As I say, I'm barely scratching the surface. But these ideas border on the mystical.
Yes.
Okay? Yes. It's not your typical Sunday school or even day school type of discussion. But what is, and I always try to be practical with our learning, what it is teaching us is that we each have tremendous power spiritually. First of all, we each have our own role in revealing the light of God.
Our own responsibilities,
and that should be really our number one focus, is let's make sure that we are contributing what we can contribute. And that goes into what we talked about last week, by really, you know, giving our heart to God and doing things for God, you know, even when it's not what we feel like, but we know we're doing it for Him. We are doing our part. But what we're expanding that from this parsha to see that there's a concept of doing that even for others. And the concept of when we say all of Israel are responsible for one another, you know, it's more than just a good Samaritan statement. It's actually saying spiritually we have power to really be able to reveal light where others are not revealing it. And that's why I say this is not just for the Kohen Gadol. This is for all of us. Somebody pointed out that whenever we daven, we say us, you know, heal us and bring us sustenance and so forth, and wisdom and repentance. When we daven, we're davening not just for ourselves, we're davening for everybody, because the goal is not that I should get on good terms with God. That's important, but what's the bigger picture? The collective goal is that God should be revealed, and that we, the world, should have an appreciation and awareness of Him. Right, right. Chatanu, the confession. Thank you. And that brings us back to the Kohen Gadol. The reason why the Kohen Gadol, one man, can cause atonement for the rest of us is because he's focusing on the we and on the us. But he really feels it. The thing about the Kohen Gadol, what makes him unique, is that, a lot of us would like to daven for other people. The question is, If in order to seek atonement for them, you had to give up your portion, would you be willing to do that? That's the clincher. Would you say like Moshe Rabbeinu, if you're going to destroy the people, take me with them? Or would you say, well, I tried my best, but I'm sorry, they didn't make it. At least let me live, God. At least let me go on with my relationship. Moshe and Aharon, they totally abandoned themselves to the notion that it's not about their own personal connection. It's about our connection. And they abandoned themselves totally to that notion, and that's why they had the power. And we can do a little, you know, we can try a little bit, but most of us are not going to get to that. Great tzaddikim like the Kohen Gadol or Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, because he didn't pray, somebody was eaten by a lion 10 miles away, he should have been out there praying for the world. But most of us, you know, are not on that, you know, halavai that we should take responsibility for our own portion. Halavai, really. To say, well, I'm not concerned about myself, I'll just pray for the other people, you know, that's a little bit dishonest. We're really not. You know, how many of us are so concerned about, you know, our own portion? So halavai, but the Torah is teaching us it is possible, and there is a system whereby one Jew can make such a difference. So let that be our insight into the clothing. Again, he doesn't wear the clothing. The clothing doesn't make him special. It's because of what goes on inside of him, inside of his heart and on his shoulders, that make him worthy of the glory of God, because that's what he lives for. He lives to see the glory of God. Nothing else. Nothing else for his personal gain. It's just to live and see the glory of God, which only comes about when all of Israel is connected. This is who the Kohen Gadol is, and this is what a person could be. Let me just, if you would indulge me another few minutes, let me just try to say something which I learned from Rav Dessler about Purim. And it's kind of connected with what we're talking about, because it has to do with revealing God through the hiddenness. A major, major theme of Purim is seeing the hand of God in a hidden way. The story of the Megillah spans about 12 years, and yet we read it in about 45 minutes. So to us, we read it and we say, wow, what a miracle. You know, that Esther was appointed, the Kuvashti was dethroned, and Esther came to power, and then Mordechai saved the king's life, and he was rewarded, and Haman was overturned. It all happened within 45 minutes. What a miracle. But it didn't happen in 45 minutes. It happened over the span of 12 years. And it was not obvious at all that this was a miracle. It was just politics. But we, you know, received this this great insight from our sages, namely Mordechai and Esther, that all that happened was indeed the hidden hand of God, and that what happened at this time is that the Jews who were living in the exile, you know, they really had lost all of the revelation of Israel and the temple. The temple was destroyed, and they were kicked out, and they were living amongst the non-Jewish nations, and they were downtrodden and oppressed, and they were going to be exterminated. I mean, it was dark. Talk about darkness in the world. That was dark. And through the story of Purim, they realized that even in the darkness, there is light. But it has to be revealed. And when they saw that it was revealed, they were filled, as the Megillah says, with ora, light, simcha, joy, sason, exaltation, and yikar, and great honor. Rav Dessler talks about this idea of revealing the light through the darkness, and the idea of joy as simcha, which is really the order of the day of Purim. I mean, merrymaking, rejoicing ourselves, rejoicing with our friends, giving gifts to the poor and to our friends, and reading the Megillah, and having a feast. It's all about joy. And in fact, the sages tell us, Misha nichnas Adar marbim besimcha. From the time that Adar begins, we slowly and steadily increase our joy. Rav Dessler asks, where does the joy come from? I mean, are we rejoicing because God is behind us? Why don't we rejoice the same way on Yom Kippur? I mean, on Yom Kippur, God is judging us. He's right there in the courtroom. Why don't we rejoice then? It's a somber time, a solemn time. Rav Dessler says that when God reveals himself and you're staring at him in the face, there's no joy. There's awe, trepidation, nowhere to move. It's like when we stood on Mount Sinai and we saw God so clearly that it was as if the mountain was held over our heads and said, if you don't accept the Torah now, this will be your grave. That means, says Rav Dessler, that we were given absolutely no choice but to see it. That does not invoke joy, that invokes fear. Joy is only invoked, is only stirred up when we have a choice in the matter. And when it looks to us one way, and then we discover that there's another way to look at it. Throughout the period of the exile, the Jews were living in darkness. And they just thought that that was a reality, which means God gave them the choice of good and evil, and they saw the darkness. They saw the dark side. And through the righteousness of Mordechai and Esther, who saw things clearly, but most people didn't see things clearly, but through their guidance and through the chain of events that God orchestrated, they came to see that there's really good behind the darkness, behind the bad. That is what creates joy. What creates joy is when you see that things are not the way you thought. And that's how you reveal the joy. That's how you increase joy. The more that is revealed, the more joyful it becomes. And it's something that only, actually, we can only experience because we have this mixture of good and evil inside of us. Angels don't have the joy that we have. Because they never, even in the darkest hour, it wasn't dark to them. They saw God all along. There's no difference between exile and not exile from the standpoint of the angels. It's only we who live in the darkness that can rejoice when we see the breaking through of the light, of the goodness. And that's what Purim is. Purim is on a higher level than Yom Kippur. Purim, you've heard before, Purim is Yom Kippur is called Ki Purim. It's like Purim. It's not exactly Purim. Purim is greater because Yom Kippur, it's fear. We see God so clearly that there's no choice. Purim is we see God when we did have a choice and when we used to look at it differently. And this is something that we can experience in our own personal lives. The more a person comes to discover, the more a person scratches beneath the surface and sees the realities of godliness and of holiness and of goodness in his own nature, in the nature of the people around him, the more he discovers, the greater is the joy. And this is what we're supposed to be looking for at this period. You gotta look for it. You gotta think about it. We reveal parts of ourselves on Purim that we don't normally do. We become more giving. We become more joyous. We increase our faith. This is all. It's all about revealing the hiddenness. Esther comes from the word Hester, hidden, and she revealed the hidden light. So,
Hadassah
was another name because her deeds were like fragrant, like the myrtle. Yes, but she's normally called Esther in the Haggadah.
With this parsha, we're learning about the Kohanim, the Kohen Gadol.
Mm-hmm.
This is before we read about the golden calf.
Right.
Originally, though, the firstborn were supposed to be
perfect.
The priests, right? That's what they lost with the golden calf thing.
It would have been what?
The firstborn.
The firstborn would have been the priest. That's
okay.
Right.
So how come, before the golden calf business, we have all this business about the high priest and the priest that has nothing to do with the firstborn?
I mean, the question is even bigger than that, because according to many commentators, there wasn't even going to be a Mishkan if there hadn't been the sin of the golden calf. And that's out of order. So, you know, if you follow that opinion, then you say that the Torah is not written chronologically. And that indeed the whole commandment of the Mishkan and the high priest would not have... It really came after this episode. If you follow the other opinion, that it is chronological, which is the opinion of Nachmanides, so then you have a little bit of a question.
At this point, Laura is talking to Moshe, right? Moshe is not relaying this information to the people at this point.
True, but why would God even be communicating these instructions if this was only Plan B?
Where is this instruction being given?
In the desert.
On Mount Sinai.
What's happening down in the valley while he's up on the mountain?
They met the golden calf.
But before or after they make it? They make it at the end of the 40 days. Maybe he's talking to him during the 40 days.
Or somehow or other his knowledge is chronological, that he does not know about events yet to happen.
So what you're saying is that we may not have known that, you know, he was preparing, like there's an expression, God provides the remedy before the ailment. And we may not have known that it should have been the firstborn, or that they were being replaced by the Kohanim, but God had already, in his vision of the future, had already prepared for the eventuality of the priests, even though the sin hadn't been committed.
If he'd given Moshe all the instructions about the firstborn and everything, you know, and all that, giving him all the instructions and everything, then he would have had to he would have said, well, come back here, I'm going to revise what I said. I'm going to change the rules. And one of the things about the Torah is the rules don't get changed.
True, but all this stuff, especially if there is the idea that we weren't going to even need a Mishkan.
Well, didn't Moses go back up?
He could have told them that after
down,
we came by the need
for
Mishkan.
Going on, they went back up for another 40 days?
Right, but that was the second 40 days was really just to seek atonement for the sin.
Yeah, it is. It's a revision.
He wasn't really getting... I don't think he was learning more Torah.
We were supposed to make it there since Israel in 3 days.
Israel Killian, I think,
has
more.
Because of the spies, there was a revision. You're going to be out here for 40 years. That's a revision.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a revision by saying, okay, we've gotten to this level. You're going to have a Mishkan. And this is how that's going to run.
I don't see the parallel because the 40 years was a punishment for having failed to follow the Lord's instructions. Here the Lord is giving instructions.
But we don't need
the Lord is giving instructions.
We don't need these instructions if we don't commit the sin of the golden calf.
Well, you might therefore say that there's a predestination involved here. And that gets you off on another subject.
That's right.
You know? That it already was, he already knew what was in the hearts of the people. He knew that these were weak people. These were weak people.
Yeah,
these were not the people.
He didn't have to go into 40 years either because he already knew that.
Well, God's knowledge does not preclude from people playing out their decisions. That's okay. I mean, God can prepare the path based on his omnipotence and still let things take their course.
Right.
Well, we'll see in here.
But I never thought of it. That
actually does preface the 40-year thing while he's talking to Moshe when Moshe comes down off the mountains. He does hint that this is possibly going to happen. That this generation may not see the land of Israel. So. And Moshe comes down much worried because of this.